Kristen.
And I'm Feeny.
And this is Brainstorm. And today we're with
Mark Harris, co-founder and CEO of HeroWare.
Well, thank you for coming today. Interested to get to talk to you about HeroWare, your company. And in doing some research, it looks like you had started this with a couple, can we call them friends?
Yeah, my co-founders. Yeah, Matt and Carl.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
How did y'all meet?
Yeah, so the connection came through Vanderbilt. Uh-huh. So I'm actually a triple door. So I stuck around at Vandy for a good like 12 years and I keep in close contact there. So I'm on the advisory board of technology transfer office there. And Vanderbilt has continued to get sort of more entrepreneurial friendly and are mm-hmm. looking to do more spin outs and establish more businesses based on their core intellectual property. And that advisory board, the goal is to bring in some business leaders in Nashville to help them do that and vet companies. And so we get to see a lot of cool new technology coming out of Vandy. So yeah. I was looking for my next business to start, but I didn't have the idea. So I was looking for folks around town with that, you know, spark of an idea, but maybe not the experience and the know-how. How do I actually get the business going? And so Matt and Carl came and actually presented to the group, and I was kind of enthralled with the technology that they had developed from day one and sparked up a conversation with them that led to the three of us joining forces to spin out the technology.
Yeah, wow. Very cool. So getting back to, you mentioned triple door at mm-hmm. Vandy.
Yep.
Looking at your LinkedIn, it mm-hmm. looked like you had gone through as far as getting your PhD. Mm-hmm. And then was there a switch?
Then I realized I had not done a lot of thinking about what I actually wanted to be when I grew up. So I always joke with people that going through PhD programs is usually people that are like enthralled with whatever that is. For me, it was loving science and the pursuit of truth, mm-hmm. but generally not as much thinking about what is the actual career path.
Right.
So for me, I kind of realized halfway through my dissertation research that I was more of a business guy at heart mm-hmm. and started looking for kind of the off ramps outside of the laboratory. And I ended up actually getting accepted into a joint PhD MBA program at Vandy. I think I'm the first one to have kind of gone through that. So I was the guinea pig. But in that, once I got accepted, I had to sort of finish my dissertation research before they let me start school over at Owen.
Sure.
And so I actually ended up reading Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Work Week during that time and basically deciding, hey, let me start a business kind of nights and weekends to see if this is even the direction I want to go or not. Mm-hmm. And so I started my first company then, which was a triathlon training DVD company, and just fell in love with entrepreneurship and knew I had a lot to learn and I wanted to definitely go the MBA route.
Yeah.
And supplement my education.
So you willingly put yourself through all those science classes in the pursuit of truth and then decided to switch and focus on business and entrepreneurship.
Yep.
Got it.
Yep.
You must love school.
Exactly. It worked all right for a while there.
You like to learn new things.
Yeah. What I really like, I found one of the things that inspires me and a lot of the people I spend a lot of time with and I really appreciate insights into is folks that come at a problem with like two different skill sets and sort of where the edges meet across mm-hmm. those skill sets. I always find fascinating because they usually have a little bit of a different insight into problem solving. And so for me, that was really the science and the business like intersection. I knew I wanted to kind of live there.
In that space. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very cool. Are you from Nashville then? Is that how you came upon
Vandy? No, originally New York and Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And then I spent my high school years over in London, England. Oh, wow. And then I came back to Nashville for Vanderbilt.
So you've lived all over.
Jumped around a little bit.
Yeah. Interesting.
That's awesome. Were you excited with Vandy beating Bama?
Ooh.
Honestly, I pay no attention to sports, so I was unaware until a conference call the next day where people were giving me the update.
Well, you spent so many years there, you know.
Yeah, I did have a bunch of people texting me. I was totally confused.
But... You're like, what's going on?
You're totally oblivious. Oh, the goalpost is where?
Yeah.
That's funny. So with your first 4-hour work week, you know, your nights and weekends, kind of exploratory entrepreneur. Mm. You mentioned a triathlon training DVD. Mm-hmm. So do you have a running, just sort of a side interest hobby?
Yeah, I guess. I'm a big endurance sports athlete. So at Vandy, I ran for the cross country and track team, and then ended up, I could go way down a rabbit hole here, but everything from competitive road cycling to triathlons to adventure races, and then now I do more ultra marathon distances. So long distance running in the mountains is kind of my favorite.
Oh my gosh. Do you, okay, sidebar. This is a documentary I watched on Netflix a couple years ago. Apparently there's like this secret ultra race and it's in Tennessee and you have to know
Barclays
some.
The Marathon?
Yes.
Yep.
Have you ran that?
I have not.
Do you know the secret to getting in? Cut this.
If it's super secret. Yeah.
There's like code word or something. Like you have to do something or know someone.
Folks, I know folks that have been there. Yeah. So if you have an interest, we could
absolutely
talk
not. I don't
run.
Have any interest. I mean, ultras are, that is a different kind of like physical, you have to, like,
the mental side of it, I think, is also
huge. You have to sleep in between and your feet are getting ripped apart on the trail. Like, it's just a totally other level of endurance that I don't know that I could aspire to reach.
You have to like to suffer.
And yeah.
I feel like it's really similar, honestly, with entrepreneurship. Just have to put in.
Yeah.
You got to be willing to kind of
the mindset,
just gut it
go
out.
The distance, literally.
Yeah.
And figuratively.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I was gonna say, did competing in sports like that, you know, kind of set you up for the entrepreneur life?
That's an interesting question. I think it's, for me personally, it's like being super goal-driven and results-oriented, like, links those two up.
Yeah.
So like an ultra, it's like how you going to get through 50 miles or 100 miles and keep yourself going when you think you have to stop, and just overcoming those obstacles, because
you're alone for a lot of the race.
Yeah.
It's just you, absolutely, yourself, and your thoughts.
And it's the same thing starting a business. Like,
sounds,
you're
going to
face challenge after challenge that seems insurmountable, but you got to kind of keep faith in that end goal and that confidence you can get over it and accomplish it.
Yeah.
And just keep pushing.
Impressive.
Very.
So in your time growing up in New York, Pennsylvania, what were some of your, did you have any kind of hindsight moments with where you're at today, kind of looking back and saying, like, you know, wow, that's really kind of what inspired me to take this path? Was there any inspirational moments from your childhood?
The closest would be just a few, you know, sort of small businesses, you know, back in the day, that was more experimentation. We're probably a little bit aligned with that, but I'd say there was a lot of just kind of personality changes along the way as I learned and gained confidence, etc.
Sure.
Over time, so a little bit difficult.
A little bit of everything.
To see. Yeah.
Yeah. Were either of your parents entrepreneurs, or anyone in your family that kind of set that path?
No, not at all. This was a new one. Absolutely. No, my dad was an attorney, and so he was definitely a, you know, follow the path kind of guy, but I think that's maybe partially the kind of obvious trajectory into graduate school. May have been a little bit, that was the family I was kind of surrounded by. Most people were going down that path.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, you still, in pursuit of truth, went down, you know, the science path, maybe law, science. I don't know if you can draw the two together.
Yeah, I think they're linked.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, great.
Because, you know, you were the first to kind of explore that route for yourself. Did you have any mentors along the way that, you know, really inspired you?
Yeah. I think there's definitely, I try to, as much as I can, kind of surround myself with people who have been there and done that before. For me, the real, so I went to business school, sort of expected I'd finish up, work for a big company, and kind of come back to entrepreneurship later after I'd kind of learned more. And it was during my summer internship where I came up with the idea for my last business, which was around data and analytics in the healthcare space around genetics and kind of the explosion of the genetic testing space. And I was working in a genetic testing lab, and that's what kind of sparked the idea. But I came back, and again, I was like, well, I'm interested in this. I'm going to kind of take as many hours as I could doing independent study to kind of see if this is going to actually lead anywhere. But I had a couple great job offers that I figured I would take and kind of last minute went and pitched to the Jumpstart Foundry, which was an accelerator program around that time. And the Entrepreneurship Center had just opened up. And it was that room full of 50 or 60 kind of experienced entrepreneurs who selected me to be a part of the program was like why I did it, because I wanted to surround myself. I'm like, these guys believe in me. That's enough to kind of turn down the job offers and see where this journey takes me.
Yeah.
And so they really helped early on set me up with mentors who had kind of been there, done that before. Mm-hmm. And that's something I've tried to continue to carry on throughout the years. That's
interesting. Awesome. So you did some entrepreneurship initially with genetic testing and some things around there. I think I saw on your profile page it was called Concert Genetics. Is that right?
That's correct.
Are you still involved with that today?
Yeah, I'm on the board.
Okay.
And so that company, I spent about 8 years kind of building that company up. We sold into hospital systems, health plans, device manufacturers, laboratories, et cetera. So that was a great opportunity to kind of go in, see an emerging problem in the market and kind of build technology solutions that would help these different players interact more efficiently. And the really nice thing looking in the rearview mirror was there was this iterative process of, hey, work with a big enterprise client to try to understand their problems in this space, figure out how to solve it, launch sort of a technology tool in there. And as a part of that, we would also be able to ingest additional data from our partners that we could use to improve the tool and then launch additional services to sort of the next player in the market. And we sort of
kind of like feeding itself.
Yes. It created this like beautiful flywheel. And it was really inspiring because these different players in the healthcare space, a lot of the times are like butting heads and in some ways are kind of competition's the wrong word, but there's friction, you know, between a health plan and a provider and a laboratory. And we were able to basically take the position of, hey, the reason there's friction across all these things is like the data infrastructure really wasn't built properly and there's not like clear information flow. And so it was really inspiring for myself and the team because it's like we can actually improve this for all these different players. And create just efficiency across that market. So I spent about 8 years building that company and kind of got hungry to do another one. So recruited in my replacement, trained him up. As I mentioned, I remain on the board. Company's doing great. And got a chance to go do another one.
That's
a serial entrepreneur.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So came across the idea with your partners, Matt and Carl.
Yes.
For HeroWare. And so once you kind of heard their pitch and saw you had an interest, started having conversations, what kind of led to the evolution of you sort of getting out there into the world and starting it up?
Yeah, so the history there was the initial concept's kind of cool because so Carl, he co-directs this Center for Rehabilitation Science and the engineering department over at Vanderbilt. So he works with a lot of like prosthetic limb development and trying to avoid injuries and in a variety of different areas. But he basically had a couple young kids and started getting back pain, which a lot of new parents have, right? Carrying around a child. And he's like, how is this 20-pound child destroying my back, right? And that's like every new parent thinks that, but like, he's a world-leading, you know, engineer in the space.
He's
so
like,
he went back to the lab and he said, hey, hey, guys, can you develop me something that would offload my back that would be so transparent like I could wear it underneath my clothing? That was the genesis of the idea to solve really his own problem. And so that was back in 2015. So they spent a good kind of 4 years developing this core technology. And it was during their first kind of public presentation in 2019 of this, and they had just inbound interest and requests to purchase prototypes from some very large enterprise clients. And that's what was the light bulb over their heads. Hey, there might be a business opportunity here. And that led them to then come and pitch our group. And that was the hook that particularly got me interested.
Yeah.
Because in my previous business in the genetics space, we had a lot of, we were ahead of the curve. And so we had a lot of like education to do within the market to show them the need.
Right.
And what I wanted to do for my next business is find something that we could do really innovative, but it had sort of pent up market demand for a solution. And that's effectively where we ended up was that's back pain.
Right.
And there's a heck of a lot of people in the world that are moving heavy objects and need a solution. And they kind of, you know, really stumbled upon that with a really unique solution. And so that was what really caught my eye initially.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
I noticed that you guys launched the company right when COVID was happening.
Oh, yes.
How did that affect the business? Was it beneficial or did it hinder business?
Ooh, that was a tough one.
Yeah.
So we're getting ready to do the big launch, which was, going to be March 1st of 2020.
Yeah.
And so we're like getting ready to do, we needed to do this big launch at this safety conference. You know, we needed to spin up the website and do all the shooting and everything, but everything was in Nashville was getting locked down. And so we literally the day before Nashville kind of closed doors on all businesses, we were able to get a studio, do a photo shoot, you know, get the models in to shoot everything the day before it all shut down.
Wow.
So that was our initial kind of set of assets.
Oh my gosh.
And then, we ended up having to launch the business and the product remotely at that conference. And so that was, you know, in my house with an engineered background to try to make it look professional.
Yeah,
it was very challenging. And then meanwhile, you know, we launched and then we had to ramp up manufacturing. So normally you do it the other way around, but this was, you know, a new product. So we launched and then we started ramping up manufacturing. Well, we were doing overseas manufacturing and we couldn't travel to visit our manufacturing plant. You know, there's language barriers. So you can imagine the sort of 6 months of challenges trying to get a high quality product when you can't actually physically put your hands on it without weeks of shipping back and forth.
Wow.
Super challenging.
Do you think that, you know, when people actually got their hands on the products, I know people were ordering everything online because they couldn't leave their homes.
Mm-hmm.
Predominantly, I know the people that are wearing the suits are working, you know, they're working for Amazon, they're working for UPS, they're working for FedEx. Did that help boost the business? Like, did you have partnerships that kind of progress that?
Yeah. So the way that started was, we mainly are selling into, enterprise B2B. So you're spot on with some of those big name clients, but it's pretty much any company that is handling, you know, physical goods, so warehouses or manufacturing facilities, et cetera. So what's been really amazing is since we launched, we've had just consistent inbound interest from these very large companies. And so generally the process is you either virtually or in person are getting out there, meeting with them, putting the suit on them, letting them feel it, putting it on some of their workers, getting feedback. And then usually that's going to result in initial purchase. So think about it as a pilot. You might have, 10 or 25 or 50 units. They're going to test it on a subset of their shift over some period of time. Usually that's a few months to get kind of the data and feedback from the workers and then start to expand over time. So getting there in person once we kind of got through COVID was really critical to ensure they had a good experience. Because the reality is, if you hold up an exosuit and I kind of was to hand one to you, you'd say, okay, how do I put it on? Mm-hmm. Like, what is it? It's not a pair of shoes that everybody knows how to handle. It's something new. And right now, there's still some market education we have to do on that front.
Mm. For people who don't know, can you explain kind of like a brief overview of what the product is?
Yeah. So it's so when I say exosuit, you're probably thinking some, you know, big mechanical motorized.
I'm thinking Iron Man.
That's right.
Tom Cruise movie where he's in like the robot and he's in the war.
Day After Tomorrow.
Yes, yeah, Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah, it is not at all like that. So those were actually, even just the prop versions were, it was either 70 or 80 pounds. And ours weighs about 2.5 pounds.
Okay.
So think about, there's an upper portion that looks like a very small backpack. If you're familiar with like a camelback, you basically put that on like a backpack. there are thigh sleeves that attach on the upper thighs. And then in between the two along your back are basically two thick rubber bands. So think like exercise bands you'd find at the gym, right? And so as you lean forward or you go down into a squat, the bands stretch along your back, and that basically acts like artificial back muscles, and it offloads 20 to 40% of the load off the back. So it's a very simple mechanical design, but again, our focus was the providing the assistance was the easy part. The really hard part that nobody had been able to crack is make it lightweight, make it breathable, make it so comfortable that the worker actually wants to wear.
Right. So that as they're walking around, it's not like a big clunky attachment.
Yep. Yep. And that's, I mean, people have launched exoskeleton companies for decades now, but everything has been too big, bulky, and awkward. Mm-hmm. And so that's really how we're setting ourselves apart in the marketplace.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah.
So currently, I'm sure we may not be able to talk about this, but well, it is on your website that you had partnered with the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so that, to me, seems like such a huge opportunity to help people in all areas of armed forces. Mm-hmm. How did you make that connection, and what's that been like?
Yeah, so that was one of those early outreaches almost immediately after we launched in 2020. And so we got an outreach from the U.S. Army who said, hey, we have a major issue with back injuries. And they've published all this data where they have 470 back injuries a day in the Army.
No way.
If you can imagine. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a massive problem. And they're saying, hey, specifically the initial concept was, hey, is there a way to offload the backs of for our artillery battalions? And so Fort Campbell is kind of an hour up the road from Vandy. And so there was a program they put in place, which was first of its kind, which was between Army Futures Command and Vanderbilt, called the Pathfinder Program. And the idea was to have soldier-inspired innovation of new technologies that they needed, rather than the typical kind of general down innovation that they have in the DoD. This was going to be a sort of a soldier up innovation. Mm-hmm. And so we spent, you know, hundreds of hours on base. Initially, this was done out of Carl's laboratory at Vanderbilt, that interaction, then that shifted over to HeroWear specifically. And we were able to create an exosuit based off of our core design, but that they had some special needs. So, for example, it had to integrate with their ballistic vests.
Sure.
And the main use case is pretty extreme, right? So you've got a soldier who has 50 pounds of body armor and gear on them, and they're picking up 70 to 90 pound artillery shells repeatedly. Yeah. So you can imagine the strain you've got in that kind of a situation. And so it was really great way to kind of stress test our technology and then work with them. And a lot of that core underlying technology also helped us develop sort of a second gen of our product, the Apex 2. Mm-hmm. And both the Apex 2 and the Saber, which was our defense product, were launched in 2023. So we've got a ton of learnings from the Army and also just from more the industrial use of our first generation exosuit to develop the next generation.
Wow.
And then since then, we've seen a lot of interest in other militaries around the world as well. And so recently, we were able to just announce a significant partnership with the Australian Defense Forces, and specifically their air forces are doing a significant rollout as well.
Oh my gosh.
Thinking of this, was the name always HeroWear, or is that just ironic that it you know, you're literally giving it to America's heroes?
Yeah, it was from day one.
Okay.
And so the way we thought about that was the when you look across, so this blew my mind. I didn't come from the industrial space or the logistics world, and it blew my mind from the beginning just how many people physically are moving boxes for their day-to-day job. It's a third of employed Americans. So you're talking 50 million Americans, primary job tasks is lifting and leaning tasks. And a lot of folks are just unaware of that, but they literally carry the economy on their backs every day. Like, our store shelves would not be stocked with goods. Your Amazon packages wouldn't be delivered. Like, nothing would happen without these people. So to us, they're the heroes of the economy. And unfortunately, if you look historically at, like, back injury rates, while you see other areas of, like, musculoskeletal, like, you know, shoulder and wrist and other areas, like, have dropped significantly as new protective equipment has come in, back injuries have stayed steady because nobody's been able to solve a way to offload their back. So for us, those people deserve protection, and that we want to arm them, and hence HeroWear.
That's awesome.
Very good question. Cool name. Very fitting now that you're partnered with the military, because as you said.
And the fact they reached out to you, that's so cool.
Yeah.
You know, they just enjoyed your product and wanted to share it with the world.
One of the things that's been wild with this whole journey has been all of our clients reach out to us. We don't do any cold outbound. So we're working with, you know, over 300 companies now, and they all have come through our website.
Wow.
Which is pretty spectacular. Yeah. To me, that's just a clear indicator of the market need for this type of product.
So is the business primarily business to business rather than direct to consumer?
Correct. And that's something, like, broader. The vision for this company is really phase one. You get an EXO in every warehouse, right? It's really focusing on these industrial workers. Phase two is an EXO in every garage. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, that's on our product roadmap to introduce a direct-to-consumer version of this down the road. But we want to learn how to build really great exosuits, drive additional awareness and adoption in the industrial setting first, and then get to a point where just like everybody has a power drill in their house, even though most of us don't use a power drill every day, like, why shouldn't we have an exosuit? Because everybody is doing some bending and lifting tasks at some point and needs one.
Sure. Wow, that's great. So we're still in phase one then.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Of the HeroWear legacy. Do you have a timeline of when you're looking to approach phase two? Or are you still just
not that I can talk about finding today?
That's proprietary.
Fair enough.
Nice try.
Had to ask. But I'm sure with how you're doing business today, it's so helpful to get to do, like you mentioned, the demos on site, getting direct feedback, being able to take that feedback and maybe make some improvements to your product, whereas direct to consumer, it's probably a lot harder to get that direct feedback. I mean, there's reviews, but, you know, how much weight can you really put in a online review? So that's a great way to kind of, like, get the product out there and work through some kinks and then.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Exactly. And what's cool is we have really good market indicators that a direct-to-consumer product, when we're ready, will be great. Because when we launch these in companies, so a lot of companies, you know, will have these kind of locked down. You know, hey, there's a room, you put it on. When you come in on your shifts, you put it back. There's some other businesses, usually a little bit on more mid-size or smaller businesses, where it's more people can take them home. And so sometimes we would be doing debriefs with workers and, hey, what's your favorite, you know, task with the suit? And sometimes people would be like, oh, chopping wood, you know, or, oh, it was moving my kid into college. And they'd start introducing all these other things. And it's just this kind of light bulb moment where you're like, wow, this is so good. This, you know, piece of gear that you're using at work, now you want to bring it home and use it every day. And that's actually how the power drills basically came into people's homes. So it was originally a B2B product that was just used on construction sites. And the core idea behind creating the cordless drill was people started taking them home for side projects over the weekend.
Yeah.
And so I see a lot of similar corollaries between how we'll eventually get there.
Oh, I had no idea about that. And yeah, I can't imagine not having a power drill. Yeah. Not that I do any projects, but.
Well, and that's the idea is, like, hey, whatever it is, 10 or 15 years from now, hopefully you'll be able to say, I could not imagine not having an exosuit in my garage, right?
Yeah. Moving boxes, you name it.
Yeah. Yeah, I was out weeding the other day in mine and like bent over for an hour or two in my yard.
Yeah. Or like nail salon workers, how they have to, I don't know how they sit like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, my brain. I'm curious in getting feedback from some of your clients. Mm-hmm. What's one of the more helpful pieces of feedback that you've received that's helped you to improve the product?
Well, it's interesting because most helpful feedback is always what's not working, because that lets us know where to focus. So with the Apex One, the biggest challenge we had was in the Southeast in the summer, there was kind of too much heat retention in our first generation product. And so people would get kind of sweat patches on their back, and the thigh sleeves were a bit too large and made out of the wrong material. And so that was the initial challenge we faced. And so with Apex 2, we've basically eliminated that issue. And so we've done some pretty cool studies. We do a lot of work with other research institutions. I think that's the three founders coming from a scientific and engineering background. Like we do a heck of
a lot of hypotheses.
Of testing. Yes, yes.
Love data.
Love data. Blind studies.
But one of the cooler studies, well, cooler, haha. You'll get that in a second. We did these mannequins. I forget the specific institution, but the mannequins basically where you would, they would figure out a level of evaporative cooling, the level of heat retention, and they would basically like heat up these chambers with mannequins, and you could kind of clothe them and you could test. And they tested Apex 1 versus the Apex 2 versus, you know, a control mannequin that just had the typical clothing on, and were able to show that the Apex 2, the heat retention is the same as just wearing an extra t-shirt.
Okay. Oh, wow.
And the 1 was like a significant increase. And so that was like, gave us huge confidence, like, okay, we've solved
we
it.
We did
but,
it.
But that was a good example of just getting feedback from clients and then iterating on the design to make sure it works for them.
Yeah.
I also saw on your website that you're able to fit for women as well. And I, you know, being able to fit such a range of people, how did you kind of figure that out?
That was super important from like day one, because what we saw was there were some exos on the market that more used like rigid components that would sort of, so if you think about ours being bands along the back, any kind of exo is all about putting torque about the hips. Mm-hmm. So sort of as you go down, it loads the suit. And then as you stand back up, it's returning energy. And so you could do that a variety of ways. And some of the competitive products would have sort of plates that press down on your thighs and the chest plate that presses up on your chest. And obviously right away you're like, okay, 50% of the population is not gonna wanna wear that.
Yeah. Right.
And so for us, like from day one, it was, we wanna make sure we've got just as good a fit for men and for women. Because, and it depends a little bit industry to industry, but generally it's about 50-50 mix. Mm-hmm. And we have had really big aspirations since day one. And it's like, you have to be able to fit everybody, no matter shape, size, gender, et cetera. And so that is one of the biggest design challenges we face, is how do you fit? I mean, we've fit a guy that was 7'6" and 425 pounds.
Oh my gosh.
And, you know, 4'8". 80-pound female, like, how do you do that, right?
Yeah.
It's super challenging from, like, a soft goods design perspective.
For sure.
Wow.
Are they all custom-made, or they have, like, you can flex the straps and...
Yeah, great question. So those are the two extremes. And so, like, from day one, you have to, if you're designing an exosuit, you've got to say, hey, are we going to make more or less a one-size-fits-most, or are we going to create a modular design that allows you to mix and match components to fit the body type? So we ended up doing a modular design, and that just makes logical sense, too, when you think about, we're used to buying clothing that are, you know, whatever, small, medium, large, and there's some flexibility there. But with an exosuit, like, it has to fit both the upper body and the lower body, and so you can... You know, everybody knows folks that have, you know, a broader top and really skinny legs or vice versa. And it's like, how do you make that work? And so for us, it's we've got three main components. So we've got the shoulder strap areas that are based on chest circumference, and then the bands that are based on basically height and torso length of an individual. and then the thigh sleeves based on thigh circumference. And so you can mix and match them to fit any body type. So what we tend to do is, and this was another key learning from clients, because early on it was like, oh, just take these measurements for your workers who are going to use it and we'll ship the suit that they need. Well, there's all kinds of challenges, including like really bad measurements that would come back where you're like, that's not physically possible for somebody to have 4-inch legs, right? It's just like, okay. So what we ended up doing, that was something where we modified the product. So if you want to fit 25 workers, we fit now tens of thousands of workers at this point. So we know the average kind of bell curve of sizes. So if you want to outfit 25 workers, we send a kit with different size components in a bell curve that we're confident is going to fit any 25 people in your workforce.
Gotcha.
And then if there's turnover, so let me back up one step. So you fit the worker, you kind of dial it in, and we have a train the trainer program. Mm-hmm. So now it fits you. It's not necessarily going to fit anybody else on your shift. Doesn't matter. You kind of have your name on it. It's yours. But if there's turnover, if you leave, get promoted, whatever, somebody else takes your spot, well, now you can basically swap components in and out to make it fit the new person.
Gotcha.
So it's not customized and unique to each person, but it is customizable.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Not one size fits all.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Awesome.
What are, as you kind of got started with the business, you know, you had this idea, you're excited about it, you start testing it. What are some things that came out of some of the feedback that you received that you were like, I never even thought about this? Like an application for the product that just didn't occur to you at the time?
Well, obviously, nail salon technicians is a new market for me. It's like literally every week we hear of new things, and it never ceases to amaze me, like the new ideas folks will come up with.
We actually had one when we were talking before. Pregnant women want, like, their bellies weigh so much, like having something that could provide a lift.
Yeah, maybe that lift us from the back.
From like day one, my wife was like, integrate it into the baby Bjorn. Like, please. Like, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a bunch of really interesting applications. I think about it like broad swaths of the industry. So, like, right now we do a lot in logistics and manufacturing. But, I mean, construction has some unique needs because you have to integrate with tool belts, and there's fall protection harnesses and other types of gear. Healthcare is really interesting. Actually, nurses have one of the highest rates of back injuries of any profession. They're helping patients.
Yeah.
And,
what about the patients, like for rehab? Is that an application that?
Not so. There's definitely been some clients that have tested our technology and other similar types of technology, like in back to work programs. So I hurt my back, I can't come back to work. Hey, if this offloads it, maybe I can get back to work a little bit faster and build some strength back. So folks have tested that. I'm staying away from kind of pure rehab in terms of like actually needing to classify as like a medical device. Mm-hmm. There are some exos in there that actually like help paraplegic people walk. There's kind of big power devices that do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We generally haven't really gone there.
Okay. Yet. It's almost more preventative rather than.
Yes. After. Preventative versus curative is the way we think about it. So we're like firmly in the preventative camp.
That makes sense. Yeah. Preventing back injuries before they even happen.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. But then it's just literally like any job you can think of where somebody has repetitive lifting or a sustained
or
leaning task. Yes. Yeah.
Besides COVID, were there any other hurdles that the business kind of had to deal with? Or was it kind of from the get-go, you know, self-marketing?
High demand.
There's always challenges for sure. Overseas manufacturing, especially in the early days when you're small, can be challenging. As we've gotten, you know, our volumes up, we've been able to move towards better manufacturing partners that can really scale with us that have much, much higher quality. So that there's some challenges just going through that process and being here in the US and needing to get people out, you know, to the Far East and working with those partners and finding them and all the rest. Definitely some challenges there. And then just generally, I mean, part of the challenge with this whole market is just, it's not a normalized technology right now. You need to, you know, continue to educate the market and like, what is even an exosuit? Where do I use it, et cetera? So a lot of the challenges and learnings like linked together have been around, how do you introduce this to workers? How do you drive their interest and adoption? Because there can be skepticism as they're coming in and saying, hey, management's telling me to wear this. I don't know. There can be sometimes lack of trust in those interactions.
Sure.
And so we've had to like build out a client services team that's just really good at boom in that first, you know, 30 seconds, kind of, hey, we're here for you. Our job is you go home at the end of the day and you're not sore and you can play with your kids and do what you love. And like, we're here for you. And that has made a world of difference in just how you communicate it and train and do the implementation.
Yeah. Just educating people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. And connecting the product maybe to something on an emotional level for them, as you said, like being able to go home and not have to lay down on a heating pad. Like you can interact with your family and not be in pain every night. Like that makes a huge difference.
Yeah, that's something we just learned from our users, because we just do, again, going back to being super data-driven, like we've done hundreds and hundreds of these exit surveys with workers and ask, and it's just like they feel after the first week, they're just like, I don't hurt when I go home anymore. Wow. And then they would tell us more about that. And you'd hear these stories of just, I used to go home and just collapse on the couch because I'm just exhausted. And I'm like, lucky if I can, you know, make my kids some hot dogs for dinner and like... Now I'm on the floor, like playing Legos with them, and it's just like God, it just gets us.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's emotional.
Right, in the feels.
Totally, totally. Yeah, that's what kind of gets us just inspired about bringing this product, reaching more people with this product.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm sure. I'm just thinking about the emotional side of things. Working with, you know, the Army is probably, you know, that's probably
super very gratifying.
Emotional. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Especially when you just hear about the injury rates and early retirement rates. And I mean, military leadership has been pretty straightforward about just like, these are really, I mean, you're talking about folks carrying 100, 120 pound loads.
For sure, and crazy.
Just, they're just like,
fast.
You know, unfortunately, like these loads just break people. Mm-hmm. And like and so there's definitely been some pretty heartfelt moments chatting with people about this kind of thing.
So
definitely inspiring.
What's something as the business is growing and you're thinking about different phases of how this product could be applied, what's something that keeps you up at night in moving forward with this business?
Yeah. It's
could be good or bad.
No, it's just continuing. I think we've got a constant, we hold ourselves to a really high standard in terms of how big of a business we want to make and the impact we want to make. And so it just keeps coming back to, how do you scale faster? And we've just been consistently doubling every year. And so how do you keep doing that? Because it's not an easy thing. Because every time you're doubling, like you're going to break systems and processes that you've got internally. And like, how do you figure that out? And so the question on my mind is always, okay, what's the... we know this is a bottleneck now, and we're doing all these things to solve it. Well, what's the next bottleneck? What's going to break next that we can go ahead and get ahead of and try to fix and figure out, and trying to make it so that that growth rate is just as smooth as possible, and you don't hit any big surprises along the way that slow you down and make you stumble. But knock on wood, it's been pretty
good
smooth
so far.
Yeah.
And in growing your business, obviously, you have to grow internally as well, adding staff, personnel, people to help, client service teams for outreach efforts and education. How has that mixed in with the aspect of, you know, entrepreneurship and building a product and providing a solution for people and kind of living that dream, but then also having to deal with some of the internal growth that comes with any organization?
Yeah, I love that stuff. I mean, it's another skill set to continue to build. And like, that's one of the reasons I was seeking just a totally different industry for my next business. Like, I didn't want to do something in healthcare IT before because it's like, I know how to do that. But like building a physical product, a lot of interesting challenges here.
Like, yeah.
Need to,
that's a journey.
Yeah. And so I love that stuff. And a lot of it's like, it's finding just a great team. Mm-hmm. And specifically recruiting a leadership team that's like been there, done it before, has a playbook to execute on, and bring them into the team as we grow to help to execute on that growth trajectory.
Yeah.
And again, avoiding the stumbles along the way. But I've been loving it.
That's great. It's exciting. Finding the right people to help with some of the things so that you can focus on the company growth, the product.
That's the best part of the job for being an entrepreneur is you get to pick who you work with every day.
Yes.
Yeah.
People that have the skills that maybe you don't have to help complement help grow a good internal culture as well.
Definitely.
With the product.
Definitely.
Transitioning more to your personal life, you mentioned wife and how she made the comment about the baby comment. Do y'all have kids?
Yeah.
Okay.
We got two kiddos, so 14, 15.
So do you think you're locked into Nashville now, being someone who's lived kind of everywhere, or is this going to be home for a little while?
We'll see. For a little while.
Is that proprietary?
I always assume, like, when you're jumping into, you know, getting a new business up and going, that's, 5 to 10 years, maybe more. And so we're definitely, you know, locked in right now, but my wife and I are both explorers at heart, and definitely think there are mountains in our future somewhere in the world. And I think a big part of me as well was, living internationally during high school is awesome. My dad did the same thing. My brother did the same thing. And so with his family recently. And so I love the idea of living internationally for a while, but we're gonna see this here where thing through first.
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah.
Having your wife, I'm sure, you said she's an adventurer as well, does it help to have like a support system like that, especially with entrepreneurship? I know it's not for the faint of heart.
it's fantastic. She's always been from the beginning, just
your hero
to chase down. She's like just sort of chasing down the dream. So we would always joke that, that she, kind of handles the day-to-day funds, and I work on the retirement account, so I'm always doing the high risk, potentially high reward things.
Yeah,
and she just
you make a good team
along. So absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. Are your kids big runners as well? Do they like to run with you, or they have any interest?
No,
in sports?
No, they kind of do
Can
their
they
own
walk
thing.
Yet?
So there's Gavin is he's a swimmer.
Okay.
And then Troy has done cross country. He's more into mountain biking right now.
Very cool.
But that's both. I'm working on them sports. on the running piece. So we'll keep it going.
Is the runner's high real? Yeah. I don't believe the hype.
Oh yeah, but there's also a lot more low than high.
Yeah.
So when it comes, it's really good.
Much needed, I'm sure. Do you do a any like obstacle runs, or do you have an interest there? Is that
I haven't.
A different category?
No, those
of
are
endurance?
Those are definitely interesting, but I'm more worried about injuries with those. To be
That's
honest
fair.
With you,
yeah. There's so it's a Tough Mudder next weekend coming to Nashville.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I've got a number of friends that do those. Mm-hmm. I do like one of the things I've been debating, kind of getting back into again, was for several years there I was just doing a lot of mountaineering and alpine climbing. I was also a climber back in the Vandy days. I led climbing trips for Vanderbilt, which was super fun. But it's just tough to have too many hobbies. You gotta kind of pick and
commit for all those hobbies.
Pick your favorites. Yeah, I get that.
So I like to do one or two big adventures a year, and then kind of spend the rest of the year just kind of prepping and getting ready
training.
For that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Exactly.
Do you watch your DVDs from your first venture to help train?
It's probably
I can't find a DVD player anymore, right?
That's so fair. Yeah,
it's all streamed now. Mm-hmm. Put it on YouTube. With your time living internationally, do you feel like there's something that kind of stuck with you from that time that you kind of carry with you as you go into different opportunities? Like something that was different than your experience in the States that you really feel helped you?
I love getting I think just the recognition of different cultures, different languages, different ways of sort of viewing the world is a really good skill to have, to be kind of open to all of that. And that's, I think there's probably bits and pieces of that that are helpful with what I do now too, because just the way you'll, you know, talk and interact with the CFO of a large global company is very different than the person moving boxes on the receiving live in their, you know, receiving line in their warehouse, right? And so there's a little bit of this sort of, you know, chameleon aspect there that you can apply that can be super helpful in helping to be able to transform a little bit in your personality or, you know, ways of talking, et cetera, to kind of fit in with the folks that you're working with. So I remember having a lot of those thoughts in high school. Like I would sort of flip on the English accent if I'm talking to my folks who are British, and then you'd kind of flip back into other things depending on where people are from.
So. Yeah, you can chameleon to to your audience.
Yeah.
Not something you can learn in school for all your time and studying at Vandy. Having those skills has to come from experience and just seeing different cultures, living in different places, meeting new people, kind of bringing the two together. So,
Is there a lifespan for the suit, or is it kind of, because I'm just, you know, I'm just thinking about the rubber bands. I've used elastic bands in the gym before and they've snapped in my face because they dried out. Like, is there a
any type of spring is going to get what you call spring creep over time. And so those are definitely considered consumables. You're usually looking at a 12 to 18 month lifespan for the bands. But again, because it's modular, you can just purchase new bands and swap them out. The rest of the suit, it just depends on the application. So if you're talking about, in the U.S. military and an artillery battalion and you're scraping up and crawling through who knows what, like you might wear things out a bit faster. But think about it as like a high-end backpack, the type of nylon material that it has. It can take quite a beating, but there's just certain applications. Like we've worked with concrete masons who are always rubbing up against, you know, raw concrete. That's going to wear down thigh sleeves or straps faster than other ones. But generally, expectation is sort of 3 to 4 year probably useful life of those additional soft good components.
Yeah, that's good.
Very cool.
But what's having launched in 2020, you know, we're still learning.
Yeah.
Sure. What is the price point of the different suits?
Yeah, so it's basically $1,500 for a suit.
Okay.
And that's per person, basically. And then as you purchase, that includes both the suit itself, and then there's implementation services as you get to the larger tiers. So like if you buy a 25-user kit, it's that 25 times the $14.99, but then we include a day of on-site services and virtual training and kind of the bell curve of parts. So when we talk to clients, it's sort of when you buy more, you get more services that are going to make sure it works in your facility.
Yeah, for sure.
And then generally, we've been getting a lot of great data recently on the ROI. And so the payback period on these is just in the order of a few months.
Wow.
So the really cool data we just published maybe 2-3 weeks ago was on this long-term injury reduction study we did. So we had 3 clients. On average, they saw a back injury every 27,000 working hours. Our study looked at 280,000 hours, so 10x that, and we saw 0 injuries. And so it's... Wow. When you consider the average cost on the medical side of one of those back injuries is $30,000-$40,000 plus, and then the indirect costs, meaning hey, that person can't come into work, and so I got to replace them with somebody, I have to train them, I have to get them up to speed, all that is roughly the same.
Yeah.
You're talking 70 or 80 grand per injury. So that
that
example was like roughly 800,000 in savings. And you're talking, around 100 workers. So pretty huge ROI.
Definitely.
From an HR perspective, I think it's also shows the employees that they're cared about.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. You know, they're, you know, feeling that their company actually cares if they're getting hurt because they're lifting boxes all day. Mm-hmm. So.
providing solutions for it.
There's the other cool thing that we found. We didn't expect this going in, but this is one of those we kind of learned along the way was, you know, our focus has been reducing injuries. But then as we started talking to workers and getting survey data back, the workers are telling us, hey, I'm not sore at the end of the day, and work is easier with the exosuit. Mm-hmm. So the next thing was we also knew that for these types of jobs, if you have an 8 or 10 hour shift, generally within the first hour, you kind of get warmed up and you're producing at sort of 100% of your capability. And the last 2 hours of shift, there's usually a decrease in like 20 to 30% of the productive output mm-hmm. of a person towards the end of the shift, because they're wiped out. I mean, it's a really hard job.
Yeah, they're tired.
And so then we're sitting there saying, well, heck, if everybody's feeling better, do they maintain their productivity in the tail end of the shift? So we've also done studies with a number of clients on that and seen that even though they say work is easier, there's less injuries, they're also more productive. Mm. So that's another like huge ROI for these clients. Mm-hmm. So it's like one of those things, I literally can't think of like another example of a product where it's like the workers want to wear it, they feel better, they're not going to get hurt, and they produce more.
Yeah.
It's like amazing, right?
It's a win.
Yeah.
It's the best thing ever.
Yeah.
Did I mention I like
Why
what
don't
I do?
You
Yeah, that's got to be cool to see.
Yeah, and being able to have that scientific mind to think about things mm-hmm. in that way, I think, is a very unique perspective because not all entrepreneurs have a PhD background. So you tackle that, you know, sort of data-driven side of the business and are then able to turn around and show that to your client, and the numbers don't lie, so it can be an easy sell.
Yeah.
And so
hence them reaching out to you, and you barely have to do any legwork.
totally. And that's something I think will, it's something that compounds, and that's mm-hmm. what gets me, I think, the most excited about the future of the business is like you get that great data that drives more utilization, and you capture more great data that drives more utilization, just mm-hmm. becomes the flywheel that drives the business.
Yeah. Totally. Who is your biggest competition?
The status quo is the biggest one. There are other exo manufacturers that are out there, but again, they've just struggled to get adoption because kind of too big, bulky, and awkward.
Slunky.
And so every time we've gone head to head against them, and there's dozens and dozens of these, we've won. So I'm very confident that we've got the best product out there in the market, and we're getting really good product market fit. So it's really like, it's just awareness and it's executing on the implementation.
Yeah.
Because if we drop the ball, and this is, you know, on us today, is if we just ship units to people, have at it, and we don't actually spend the time to go in there and train them properly, they're just way less likely to be successful,
right?
Because they just don't, like, again, if I put a pile of parts here for you all and I said, oh, fit each other, and how's your experience, and then work 10 hours in it, like, if you don't fit this thing properly, like, it transfers forces on your body, so you'll get rubbing in weird places, mm-hmm. like, if it isn't fit properly. So that's one of those challenges we just have to continue to overcome. And I think over time, it'll become, you know, something that's kind of second nature. If you worked in a previous job with an exosuit and now you move to this job with an exosuit and they have you build your own, like, you know how to fit it. Just like today, you know if shoes fit or not.
Right.
Yeah.
If you'd never seen shoes before, how would you know your size?
True.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting. Robots.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. Interesting. So
that's just robots.
Robots. Drop the mic. Yeah. So that is a common question that comes up, which is, hey, aren't we just going to automate these anyways? Mm-hmm. And so why are you guys bothering? This is a half measure. We're just going to go all the way to a fully automated facility. When you talk to experts in the space, they're like, we're talking 20, 30 years down the road, maybe. So you definitely have groups, and probably the biggest leader in the space is just Amazon with their resources and their scale. They are doing a great job of a lot of automation in their facilities. But even those groups, like, they have specific warehouses that are called AMXL facilities, which are for things over 50 pounds and are big, awkward, bulky stuff, right? They don't fit on their conveyor systems. They don't fit in their automation systems. So even those guys who are probably the most automated of anybody out there, like, has a lot of people physically moving product and really, really challenging to automate that stuff.
Okay.
Now, then you go down and you look at the other tens of thousands of companies that have to move physical products. The cost of automation systems right now is so high. And it's generally becomes fairly narrow. So it's like if every one of your boxes is the same size and the same weight, okay, you could look at some automation and you could be successful at that. But most warehouses we're in is really you call kind of mixed pallet. So they'll be, so take a, whatever, your favorite retailer. They're going to have a warehouse where they're getting full pallets of products that come in, get unloaded off the trucks, get put up on their shelves. But then a store is going to place an order. And so what happens is you got a guy driving a pallet jack, a guy, hundreds of people, but driving a pallet jack throughout this warehouse, and they have a pick list. So they're building a pallet for that store. And it's, I need two of those and three of those and one of those. And so they're grabbing and creating what's called a rainbow pallet. And it's just, that is extraordinarily difficult to automate. We have some clients who are trying to reduce the amount of time somebody spends on a pallet jack. So they'll actually have robots that'll go pick up the pallet, and they're autonomous and will drive the pallet to a person, but that person still has to pick it. And what's really interesting with that is what you're doing is you're eliminating unproductive time where the person is driving, but it also means you're increasing their pick rate and they don't have as much rest. And so they have seen injuries just skyrocket with additional automation, right? Which is like, that was one of those like things I did not expect either. Yeah. That's been really interesting. So we've got a client there where every place where they're putting in place these automated pallet jacks, they're also like, yeah, we need the exosuits because we're going to break our people if we don't have them. So there's plenty of runway for us in that world.
So robots are causing unintended consequences for more injuries, thereby making your product more desirable. Robots help?
It just changes. It depends is the easy answer there, because like that's a situation where you might not have as many people in the facility, but the people you have are at more risk. So they need the product more, but there might be fewer people in that particular situation. And it gets more complicated when you think about a company like Amazon that has different now. Their people are doing a lot of picking like this out of something that's, they might not be bending over as much to lift things, but then it's more shoulder and wrist and elbow type of injuries that can pick up. So it's variable, but I don't see that slowing us down for decades.
A while.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where did you come across, you said a lot of things that are very warehouse-specific language, like rainbow pallets and pilots, like, how did you come about that knowledge? Was it just through working with your customers?
A lot of the last 5 years in warehouses and
in
manufacturing
and
facilities. And because early on, it's like, does the, one of the founders of the business, like, I was the sales guy for years. And so you've got to, I'm a huge advocate of that, like CEO-led sales in the early days, because like you need to learn what people are saying, and you're going to ask questions differently than if you'd hired it out and just brought in a sales rep. And so, yeah, that was just in there asking questions, learning the lingo.
Yeah.
Being a chameleon, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, literally.
But you kind of have to be comfortable with not knowing. And that can be a challenge for a lot of people, is feeling inferior and not maybe knowing their market. And so do you feel that you came at it with an approach of curiosity, being from a science background? Like in
100%. That feels like the story of my life, really. It's like I'm going to go.
Brings it all together.
Yeah.
Like I defended my PhD and 3 days later started at business school, like never having taken an economics course. I'm like, I don't know what any of these words mean, any of these abbreviations, not a clue.
A lot of abbreviations.
And I love it. Like, I love that stuff. And then, you know, they're into the genetics world. I got to figure that out and sell the health plan. How does the health plan work? Like, figure that out. And then it's like, I'm going to drop that and go into logistics. Like, for me personally, this comes back to that thing we were talking about earlier, like, just sort of being an explorer. Like, I think if I'd been born hundreds of years ago, like, I would have been the guy out in the ship, like, what's over that horizon and figuring out new stuff.
That's just,
that gets me jazzed. So I love that. And that's
constantly
just a personality
trait
of mine, I think.
Interesting.
Passion for learning. Hence why you love school so much.
Exactly. Couldn't get out.
And then taking that passion and bringing it to just different industries and clients. And so, that's very interesting.
This is really defeating the purpose.
It's so many words. I need like a grabber.
Oh, that's a great one. That's a great question. Thanks for asking.
I didn't even get to read it.
Okay, so are there tiers to the suit? Like, you mentioned that Amazon has facilities that are over 50 pounds. Mm-hmm. Are there tiers for the suit, you know, if they're doing a lighter load or a heavier load?
Different levels of assistance. Yes. Yeah, 100%. That's also back to, like, the modular aspect of the suit. So there are three different strengths of the bands. For a military application, for example, you might want the heavier bands because you're lifting a lot more weight. And it also, like, correlates with the torso weight of the individual. So you could imagine a bigger person is going to need or want more assistance in the suit than a lighter person. And so this lets you modulate it based on both the task and the individual.
Yeah, because I'm imagining, you know, if I'm trying to bend over and it wouldn't let me bend over, then
exactly.
That would be a little hard.
Too much strength. Yeah, too much strength in the bands is a detriment.
Yeah.
For sure.
You're like trying to bend over and pick something up and you're like, sitting up.
Yep, that is a great indicator that the fit is not right.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, we know you're a busy man, and today's conversation was definitely intriguing, but thank you all for watching, and thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me.